Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in the East County Wellness Center in El Cajon. Today, we open our show with a special report on ambulance services in our region. With no public hearing, the county has signed a contract to change ambulance providers for a vast area of East County and the border region. But now, some emergency responders are sounding the alarm, saying cost-cutting by the county could cost lives due to ambulances coming from up to an hour away. Stay tuned for the shocking details of East County Magazine's special investigation. And then on Green Scene, we'll tell you why the City of San Diego is suing chemical manufacturer Monsanto. On our Capitol Report, hear about the new congressional budget proposed by the Republican majority and just what they want to cut to reduce the deficit. We'll tell you why the Neighborhood Market Association locally has decided to ban sales of powdered alcohol. And speaking of alcohol, a class action suit is claiming that many popular California wines have high levels of arsenic that plaintiffs say could harm your health, though a wine association in California insists their wines are safe. There's a new marijuana dispensary proposed in Ramona, and we'll have the arguments for and against it on today's show. The White House doesn't want to respond to public records requests for documents such as emails, a troubling move announced during Sunshine Week, and we'll have details. A recall of Kraft macaroni and cheese has been announced, but not to worry, our very own East County eater will share his own mac and cheese recipe for you to make at home. A local elected official who lost his seat in the November election may soon have it back again. Find out why on today's show. And then on our bookshelf segment, Raina Menashe interviews Ramona author Joyce Strand on her Wine Country mystery novels. We'll also tell you about an upcoming Coffee with the Sheriff's event in Santee and two blood donation drives coming up in East County. Plus, hear about a scam by people posing as utility workers that SDG&E is warning about, and learn about a World Health Organization report on hearing loss among young people and what you can do to save your hearing. We'll have all these stories and more, so stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, because East County matters. What if you had a medical emergency and the nearest ambulance had to come from Imperial County or other distant places an hour or more away? That is the very real prospect facing rural East County residents under a stealth change in ambulance service approved by the county with no public notice, no hearing, and no vote by the supervisors. Unless a public outcry can change this deal, effective April 1st, Mercy Medical Transportation, Inc. will replace American Medical Response, or AMR, as the ambulance provider in an inland San Diego region known as the Zone 2 Rural and Otay Mesa Service Area. That service area extends from Jamul east to Jacumba Hot Springs, south to the border, including the prison at Otay Mesa, and north all the way to Mount Laguna, also encompassing communities on both sides of Interstate 8, such as Descanso, Pine Valley, and Campo. In the 2012-2013 fiscal year, the area to be served had over 3,000 ambulance calls, and over 2,600 of those patients had to be transported to a hospital. Now, the county rules allow this life-or-death decision about changing ambulance service to be made without the input of supervisors or the public. The $2.3 million three-year contract was signed by John Pellegrino, director of the county's Department of Purchasing and Contracting. Rural planners were never consulted, and it is unclear whether the county ever consulted anyone with any expertise in emergency medical response other than those companies bidding on the contract. Sources interviewed by East County Magazine have stated that actually both Mercy and AMR are reputable companies that generally do the best they can with the resources provided. The question is, are those resources enough? Based in Escondido, Mercy has been around since 1993, and since 2002 it's been providing services for San Diego County and the Valley Center Fire Protection for rural areas in North County. Its president is also president of McCormick Ambulance in Los Angeles County, responding to about 9,000 911 calls a month up there. Mercy has also shown a philanthropic side. Mercy has also shown a philanthropic side, providing ambulance services free in New Orleans during Hurricane Katrina, according to Mercy's president, Richard Roche. Roche told East County Magazine, "We are proud to bring all brand new state-of-the-art ambulances and equipment to the Zone 2 rural area." Mercy plans to add an additional Advanced Life Service, or ALS, ambulance to the fleet, which will be posted in Alpine during the day and available to cover uncovered areas, but only during the daytime. So if two units in Alpine are available, one could move up to cover a call in Hamul or Campbell, though that's still a long way away. The problem, though, is inadequate budgeting by the county to adequately cover the vast East County area. Best case, there are not enough ambulances funded to cover the backcountry in a timely manner, putting lives at stake, medical transport and firefighting professionals have told our reporting team. There are two main critical areas of concern. One is mutual aid, in other words, which agency will respond if the nearest Mercy ambulance is already out on a call or incapacitated. The other issue is staffing, whether ambulances will have two paramedics or just one paramedic and an emergency medical technician. That difference is crucial, since EMTs cannot defibrillate a heart patient, they can't intubate a patient with breathing difficulties, or start an IV to administer intravenous medications or fluids. Now, the contract calls for Mercy to keep four ambulances here. Mercy promised the county it would secure seven mutual aid agreements. Now, if only 4 to 6 are signed by April 1st under the contract, Mercy would add one extra ambulance, so 5 total. And if just 1 to 3 mutual aid agreements are signed, it would add 2 extra ambulances for a total of 6. But as of Friday, only one such mutual aid agreement has been signed that can be documented through county public records and a request directly to Mercy. That agreement is with Schaefer Ambulance Service in Imperial County. Besides the concerns over very long distances to travel, there's also nothing in the Schaefer contract requiring two paramedics, or even one, on the ambulances dispatched for mutual aid. In an email last week, Roche told East County Magazine, "We currently have secured mutual aid agreements, either oral or written, with the following agencies: Viejas Fire Department, Sequan Fire Department, Julian Cuyamaca Fire Protection Ambulance Service, Mesa Grande, Schaefer in Imperial County, Santee Fire Department, and Lakeside Fire Department." But emails obtained by East County Magazine through a public record search reveal that while Mercy has reached out to many other entities to ask for mutual aid, and some did respond with encouraging emails such as Viejas stating that Mercy could reference Viejas in its proposal to the county, absolutely no mutual aid contracts have actually been signed as of March 16th other than with Schaefer, and they would have to cross desert and mountains to reach the furthest east point in East County, and even farther to reach points further west. We invited Mercy's president to be interviewed on Monday, and he initially agreed, but after we asked him to bring signed copies of mutual aid agreements, he canceled and said he would not be available until after April 1st, the very day the new contract is slated to begin. Roche claims oral agreements have been relied on in the past, but shouldn't something as crucial as backup ambulance services through mutual aid with local agencies be confirmed with a written contract as was done with Schaefer in Imperial Valley? Mark Ostrander is the former CAL FIRE Battalion Chief for rural East County. He's also a resident of Acumba Hot Springs. He expressed shock to learn of this agreement. "Oh my gosh," he said, "so we're talking 45 minutes plus." Some of the other agencies proposed for mutual aid are also outside of this service area, meaning ambulances would travel long distances, such as from Mesa Grande near Santa Isabel, Lakeside Fire, and the Barona Fire Department also in northern Lakeside. Others are within the service area, including Alpine Fire District, as well as tribal fire departments at Viejas and Sequan. Viejas and Sequan have both voiced support for mutual aid, though no signed contracts have been provided, and both are within the service area. But tribal resources have already been tapped for mutual aid to the point that at least one tribal fire department has voiced concerns that such calls are getting to be routine and that they were not being reimbursed for those costs, Ostrander told us. Tribal departments also must cover casinos, raising questions over how available help would be if Mercy relies too heavily on tribal responders who are already very busy. Under the old contract with AMR, mutual aid could come from additional sources within this service district, such as El Cajon, La Mesa, Lemon Grove, Bonita, and National City, not merely tribal sources. But those other agencies used in the past are not even on the list of 7 mutual aid entities proposed by Mercy in its correspondence to the county. Some of these cities are serviced by AMR, which may not be eager to rush to the aid of its competitor. That said, Mercy's president said he has reached out to El Cajon's fire chief, but he admitted, "We have no agreements." They have also reached out to AMR, the provider for La Mesa. Roche said that Alpine does not have a transport ambulance. Therefore, he made clear, we do not have a mutual aid agreement with them. He maintains that reliance on tribal units in Zone 2 makes the most sense, and for Mercy in turn to back the tribal departments up on their calls when they are needed. AMR has an ambulance currently based in Campo to reach areas like Boulevard and Hakumba. It's already a long response for some of these areas, but that could get even longer under the new contract with no provision for an ambulance to be permanently stationed east of Alpine based on information we've found. As for the Schaefer Ambulance Service out of El Centro, multiple sources told us that Schaefer often runs ambulances without two paramedics and that some personnel are not certified by San Diego County. Certification in our county is required to treat patients here. So where does that leave rural residents in need of urgent medical care if Schaefer's the first on the scene? Asked about staffing issues, an AMR medic who asked that his name be withheld had this to say. The county held AMR to a higher standard of care, requiring dual paramedics on every vehicle. EMTs can only take vital signs and reports, nothing else, he noted. The contract requires two paramedics on Mercy ambulances, but there is an exception. If there are advanced life support or ALS first responders in the area that Mercy is assigned to cover, then Mercy could respond with just one EMT and one paramedic. Only a handful of fire stations in this district have paramedics, though. And here's the kicker, rural fire stations have had many dark days when they were closed unexpectedly due to lack of money and manpower. Sometimes weeks at a time, in many cases, as East County Magazine has previously reported. Others have been consistently short-staffed. And at least one death occurred when two stations were closed simultaneously, resulting in a long response time for paramedics coming from two districts away. Reliance on fire station paramedics, where resources are already strained, raises the concern that a contract breach could occur if Mercy counts on a response from a station that simply isn't open or is understaffed that day. And if there's an accident with more than one patient in critical condition, only one can be treated at a time when there's just one paramedic. It's even a problem with a single patient suffering a serious health issue such as a heart attack, since with two paramedics, one can start defibrillation while the other inserts a breathing tube, for example. So how does our county compare with other jurisdictions, and just how many ambulances would it take to provide at least minimally adequate care? The city of San Diego runs 28 ambulances within its city limit, not counting another 47 firefighter paramedic units and additional help through mutual aid, sources have told us. By contrast, the county plans to have Mercy operate just 4 ambulances for the entire vast area covered in this contract. Again, that's from the Imperial County line to Jamul, from the Mexican border all the way north to Mount Laguna. Already, response times are unacceptably slow by any impartial medical standard in the rural areas. In both the old AMR and the new Mercy contract, the county requires that medical calls be responded to in 30 minutes or less in rural areas at least 90% of the time. In urban areas, that requirement is just 10 minutes. Apparently, rural lives just count less. There are also exceptions. If there's a traffic jam or severe weather, for instance, longer response times don't count against the ambulance provider's record. Rural East County gets snow, and rural highways such as 94 are often blocked by accidents. Shouldn't planning for these common and foreseeable occurrences be part of the process? As for meeting the standard that the county does require, Roche predicts, we will exceed these requirements, especially with adding a unit. He adds that in its current service area, Mercy far exceeds contractual response time standards. In fact, he says, we self-impose more stringent response time criteria than required by contracts. Currently in Valley Center, we are at 99.95% compliance, and our average response time is approximately 9 minutes. In Mariposa County, we are over 98% compliant, he said, adding that Mariposa only requires 90%. Mercy is also pursuing the idea of putting ambulances at a couple of fire stations, such as in Jamul, and relying on firefighter paramedics to staff them. Roche calls this thinking out of the box, noting that these would be in addition to the 4 ambulances staffed by Mercy. This could be better for the patient, he says, reducing patients' time to get to a hospital. But not everybody is so optimistic. Donna Tisdale, chair of Boulevard's planning group, is skeptical, after having seen problems with fire station staffing in her area on a recurrent basis despite upgrades promised by the county. Law enforcement response times are also a lot slower than elsewhere in her rural community, as we have reported previously. Tisdale states, the county is always exaggerating the level of services we will receive out here. An AMR employee who lives in the district told us, I am very concerned. He adds that response times are already too long due to the county not funding enough ambulances to serve such a big area. I know for a fact that some of the paramedics will never ride motorcycles in this area because they don't have the response time that they should have in rural East County, he says, All of the 94 highways a very dangerous road. The response times are huge. So if you have an accident with severe injuries in those areas, he surmises, you're pretty much dead. His concerns are echoed by former Chief Ostrander, who says county ambulance services are already lacking along both the I-8 corridor and Highway 94 in East County. Ostrander says there have already been deaths due to ambulances just not arriving in time. For heart attacks, anything over a few minutes means the patient likely will not survive or will have brain damage if they do. For stroke, heart attack, and serious traumas, medics refer to a golden hour to get patients to a hospital within 60 minutes. That limit is already often exceeded in East County, even with air transport. A mother, who asked not to be named, told East County Magazine that back in 2010 in Hamul, my son almost died. It took about 2 hours to get an ambulance here when he was having a seizure. Her neighbor's son was bitten by a rattlesnake, but survived thanks to air transport. But she worries about snake bites and the elderly in her community not getting to a hospital fast enough. There are also concerns over coverage of the Otay Mesa detention facilities, where the current prison population of 6,400 could rise to 8,300 during the contract term, according to figures in the county's own contract. So how did this all happen with no supervisorial oversight and no public knowledge? Well, a 2013 board action that launched the competitive bid process was, quote, routine, unquote, according to a spokesperson from Supervisor Diane Jacobs' office. It followed fixed rules about awarding contracts, partly to keep the process from being politicized. In this case, the county staff evaluated three factors equally as part of the request for proposal: program requirements, expertise, and price. Some implementation details, such as placement of apparatus, remain to be finalized. But that's just not acceptable to rural community leaders who are upset that the county is talking about funding a new stadium for the Chargers and recently spent millions on a water park while short-shrifting ambulance service for rural areas. Ostrander told us, that frosts me big time. We don't have enough money to put in a good, decent fire department. We don't have enough money for ambulance service, but we have enough money for the Chargers? That benefits only a few people, and none of the benefits will be out here, he says. The former CAL FIRE battalion chief for our region adds, this is just a blatant, callous disregard for the residents in the backcountry. So what is the ideal solution? Ostrander believes there are other places the county should cut its budget in order to increase funding for ambulance services. The county has budgeted less than $800,000 a year for ambulances in the district in question, or about $200,000 for each of those four ambulances. $200,000 each. If amendments were added to the contract with more money authorized by supervisors, more ambulances could be added. We need at least three more, says Ostrander. He wants to see an ambulance stationed at Campo, another in either Boulevard or Hukumba, and a third in either Potrero or Barrett Junction. Many rural readers are also fuming over the process and argue that the public should have been allowed to provide input on something of such critical public safety importance. While the county claims the action was routine, Ostrander thinks otherwise. He says, they were sticking this through because they don't want to get this in the media. They're blatantly trying to hide it. They don't have open government. East County Magazine asked Terry Frank, general counsel at Californians Aware, which has previously sued the county for violating open government laws, if the secrecy here is a concern. He told us, I'm not aware of any law that requires a formal public hearing based on these facts. But, he suggests, the county's penny-pinching could be penny-wise and pound-foolish in the long run. The attorney for Cal Aware concludes that just because it may be legal, that doesn't mean that the supervisors can avoid hearing from the public about the situation. He concludes, I'd expect that to happen. If not now, then when the first person dies because the supervisors saw to it that ambulance help was left too far away. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Now it's time for the Green Scene Report, highlighting energy, environmental, and sustainability issues in our community.
This is Ed Barena with the Green Scene Report. The city of San Diego has filed a lawsuit against Monsanto and other chemical companies in U.S. District Court. The suit seeks damages for harm caused by polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, in the waters of San Diego Bay, the Reader reports. In 2012, a study by the San Diego Regional Water Control Board found the city of San Diego was responsible for pollution in the bay. The lawsuit was filed in part to recoup some costs from a 2014 fine of nearly $1 million and a $6.45 million price tag for cleaning the site that the city was forced to pay. The suit filed on March 16th claims that Monsanto illegally polluted the bay with PCBs, which were, quote, not only a substantial factor in causing the city and port district to incur damages, but a primary driving force behind the need to clean up and abate bay sediments, unquote. The suit also says that Monsanto knowingly continued producing PCBs after they were banned in the 1970s. PCBs have been linked to cancer, neurotoxic, and mutagenic health effects. According to a report from the St. Louis Business Journal, the megacorporation is denying any liability, stating, quote, Monsanto was not responsible for the costs alleged in this matter. The company further contends that, quote, if improper disposal or other improper uses allowed for necessary cleanup costs, then these other third parties would bear responsibility for those costs, unquote. Monsanto has a history of producing other controversial chemicals, including the pesticide DDT, which is also banned, as well as PCBs, Agent Orange, the herbicide used in Vietnam, and bovine growth hormone. In addition, some environmentalists blame Monsanto's genetically modified Roundup Ready crops for mass die-offs of bees and monarch butterflies.
This is East County Magazine's Capital Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. This is Miriam Raftery with a Capital Report. The Republican-controlled House and Senate budget proposals call for $5.5 trillion in spending cuts, including deep cuts in Medicare, food stamps, and other social programs. The budget also includes tax cuts for the wealthy and large increases in emergency war funding for the military. In addition, it would repeal the Affordable Care Act, known as Obamacare. The Republican leadership claims it will ultimately balance the budget and produce a surplus over the next decade, but even some Republicans say the gimmicks relied on for those claims make the likelihood of achieving these goals doubtful. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, a Republican from Kentucky, claims the budget will control spending and reduce the deficit. He says it's a budget that will support economic growth and more opportunity for hardworking families while protecting our most vulnerable. And yet, the House and Senate versions of the budget both have deep cuts in programs that help vulnerable and poor Americans. Senate Minority Leader Harry Reid, a Democrat from Nevada, has stated, the Republican budget would drastically cut the tax bill for the average millionaire while raising taxes on the average middle class. That is not just irresponsible, it's immoral, The Hill reports. Reid also accuses Republicans of, quote, cooking the books by relying on overly optimistic economic projections. Even some Republicans agree with that. Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado says, I don't know anyone who believes we're going to balance the budget in 10 years. It's all hooey, the New York Times reports. And Senator John McCain of Arizona, a former presidential candidate, calls the House Republicans' version not legitimate budgeting, the New York Times says. The budget eliminates new taxes funding the Affordable Care Act and yet still assumes the same level of federal revenue that those taxes provide. How? By assuming that the Republican tax cuts for the wealthy and other economic proposals would create a, quote, macroeconomic impact, unquote, that would somehow grow the economy to $33 billion by 2025. Presidential candidate Hillary Clinton sent tweets blasting the GOP budget for taking health care away from 16 million people by eliminating the Affordable Health Care Act. And another 21 million could lose health care due to Medicaid cuts, some analysts predict. Repeal of the ACA would let insurers write their own rules again, Clinton says, also blasting cuts to Pell Grants for college students. Budgets reflect our priorities, she adds. They should help families get ahead, educate our kids, and spark small business growth. Representative Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, ranking Democrat on the House Budget Committee, states bluntly, this takes budget quackery to a new level. One person stands between the Republican-dominated Congress and seeing such budgets enacted. President Barack Obama, who could veto such extremist budgets, setting the stage for yet another showdown or government shutdown. The president had this to say in a statement to reporters at the White House. What we're seeing right now is a failure to invest in education, infrastructure, research, and national defense, all the things that we need to grow, need to create jobs, to stay at the forefront of innovation, and to keep our country safe. The president will likely be the final decision maker, since Republicans are also working to change Senate rules that would prevent a filibuster by the Democrats.
Following federal legalization of powdered alcohol sales in the United States, Mark Arabo of the Neighborhood Market Association in San Diego has announced he will restrict any sales of this new product from Neighborhood Market Association retail members. Sales of powdered alcohol will result in automatic termination of Neighborhood Market Association membership. Arabo says he has been in discussion with District Attorney Bonnie Dumanis regarding expanding this ban for all stores throughout San Diego. He says, since the approval of powdered alcohol, many of our members have notified us about the possibility of selling this product. In good conscience, I cannot risk selling this item because it poses a risk to our children and neighborhoods. Our Neighborhood Market Association members will not sell powdered alcohol in any of our stores because our commitment is not just to business, but to the people we serve. This week, the United States Alcohol and Tobacco Tax and Trade Bureau approved sale of Palcohol, a powdered alcohol that users can mix with water to create an alcoholic beverage in four flavors. Sales are slated to begin this summer to those age 21 and over. But health experts and legislators have raised concerns that powdered alcohol could be abused by minors, snorted, or concealed and smuggled into places where alcohol is prohibited, such as schools or sporting events. Moreover, powders could be mixed with other drugs, or drinks could be mixed that were more potent than recommended on packaging. Packets left within reach of small children could also potentially cause alcohol poisoning. This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine.
A class action lawsuit has been filed against 28 California wineries on behalf of California consumers who purchased wines in the last 4 years. The suit claims the wines contain high levels of arsenic up to 500 times higher than what is considered safe. However, a California Wine Industry Association insists that its wines are safe to drink. None of the wineries named in the lawsuit are in San Diego County, though it's unclear whether the lab tested any of our local wines. But the lawsuit does include major brand names such as Franzia, Ménage à Trois, Sutter Home, Wine Cube, Charles Shaw, which is Trader Joe's brand, Glen Ellen, Cupcake, Beringer, and Vendage. Most of the wines listed in the lawsuit are cheap white or blush varieties, including Moscato, Pinot Grigio, and Sauvignon Blanc. You can view the full list of brands and types of wines named in the lawsuit at a website set up by the plaintiffs at taintedwine.com. The arsenic testing was done by Beverage Grades, a lab in Colorado, and they tested over 1,300 wines, of which 83 were found to have high arsenic levels. Testing was confirmed by two additional labs. Beverage Grade CEO Kevin Hicks says, "We went looking for the answer to a simple question, what's in wine? What we found was profoundly disturbing. The levels of arsenic in some of these wines were beyond belief." Hicks, a former beverage industry executive, says he first approached winemakers a year ago with his findings, but, he notes, they heard the words arsenic and wine and the conversation was over. The Wine Institute, a trade association of 1,000 California wineries, has issued a statement indicating that it is very concerned with the health and safety of consumers who enjoy wine. But the statement reads, "We have learned of possible litigation alleging that certain wines pose a risk to consumers because they contain trace amounts of arsenic. Although we are not privy to the contents of the litigation, we believe this allegation is false and misleading and that all wines being sold in the U.S. marketplace are safe." The Institute notes that arsenic, a natural element, is prevalent in air, soil, water, and food, adding, "As an agricultural product, wines from throughout the world contain trace amounts of arsenic, as do juices, vegetables, grains, and other alcohol beverages. There is no research that shows that the amounts found in wine pose a health risk to consumers." The U.S. Tax and Trade Bureau, the agency that regulates wine, beer, and spirits, monitors wine for compounds, including arsenic, as part of its testing program. While there are no established limits in the U.S., several countries and the European Union have established limits of 100 parts per billion or higher for wine. California wine exports are tested by these governments and are below the established limits, the Wine Institute statement notes. "We are concerned that the irresponsible publicity campaign by the litigating party could scare the public into thinking that wine is not safe to consume, which is patently untrue. We will continue to keep consumers, the media, and industry informed," the statement reads. Trader Joe's has also issued a statement indicating that the concerns raised are serious and being treated as such. They add, "We are investigating the matter with several of our wine-producing suppliers." Arsenic can occur naturally in the environment, but it can also be released from agricultural and industrial sources. There are two forms, organic and inorganic arsenic. Inorganic is considered more toxic and has been linked to cancer, according to the American Cancer Society. The lawsuit contends that inorganic arsenic, the more dangerous form, is what was found in the wines tested. Inorganic compounds are typically found in industrial and building products such as pressure-treated wood and pesticides and in contaminated water. You can find a list of the cleanest wines tested on the lab's website at beveragegrades.com. Reporting for East County Magazine, this is Miriam Raftery.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
The East County Magazine show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. The East County Magazine show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
An application for a medical marijuana collective in Ramona has been submitted to the County of San Diego. If approved, it would be the county's second legally licensed medical marijuana facility situated in unincorporated areas in an industrial zone building at 1210 Olive Street. But it faces opposition. Jim Piva, chair of the Ramona Planning Group, voiced concerns during a citizens' advisory meeting at the Ramona Sheriff Station that highways in the area are already dangerous and that a medical pot shop, quote, just doesn't fit. The Ramona Sentinel reports Piva as saying, folks from throughout the county will be driving to Ramona, no fear with our roads, possibly high on marijuana. Planners don't get a vote, however, since the application process requires only a building permit to comply with zoning requirements and an operating certificate from the Sheriff's Department, after a background check and other rules are met. Lieutenant Richard Williams with the Sheriff's Office said public comments will be considered before Ramona Sheriff's Station issues a recommendation on whether or not the collective should be licensed. Advocates of medical marijuana patients contend that patients should not have to travel long distances to access medical cannabis. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Barena.
This week is Sunshine Week, when media outlets are supposed to report to the public on just how well or poorly public officials and agencies have done in responding to public records requests under open government laws. Ironically, during Sunshine Week, the White House announced that its Office of Administration will no longer be subject to the Freedom of Information Act, continuing a policy begun by the Bush administration to reject all information requests to the office. The White House says it removed a regulation that had subjected its office to FOIA regulations to be consistent with court rulings that found the office does not have to comply with transparency laws, even though it did comply with FOIA requests for 30 years until Bush took office. The Office of Administration handles archiving emails, among other duties. Is the timing of the White House action coming just after Hillary Clinton became embroiled in a controversy over deleted emails stored on a private server really just a coincidence? The administration already has the worst record for responding to FOIA requests. Ann Weissman with Citizens for Responsible Ethics in Washington, or CREW, states it is completely out of step with the president's supposed commitment to transparency. CREW sued the Bush administration after it started balking at complying with FOIA requests for some 22 million emails, USA Today reports. Presidential emails can still be obtained, but only under the Presidential Records Act, and then only after the president has been out of office for at least 5 years. So much for sunshine in the White House. In California, meanwhile, sunshine laws need some updating, a Sacramento Bee article suggests. Back in 2000, a new law gave Californians the right to access public records electronically, except that the legislature exempted itself from the law. So to compile data on legislative payrolls, for example, the Sacramento Bee's reporters had to obtain paper copies and then scan them in electronically in order to create a spreadsheet, and that led to errors such as L's being confused with I's by the scanner. Ordinary citizens, of course, may not be able to afford, let alone process, thousands of pages of paper documents, which is why more reforms are obviously needed. Yet another troubling story on sunshine, or rather the lack of it, was published by the McClatchy News Service's Washington, D.C. Bureau. That article reports that while newspapers used to be the dominant force in prying documents away from federal agencies, now advocacy groups and corporations are the driving forces. That's because newspapers today have had their investigative reporting budgets slashed, and almost none of them are spending money for court challenges to press their rights. Bloggers, activists, corporate lawyers, and other interested parties are flooding public agencies with records requests in recent years thanks to the Internet, and that's leading agencies to claim that they are overwhelmed. Those other entities are filing suit. In fact, last year, more FOIA lawsuits were filed, 422 of them, against the federal government than in any year since 2001. But those getting the information are largely corporations and special interest groups that may or may not have the public interest in mind. Now, here in East County, we've seen some strides forward, with more and more local cities putting at least some records online, such as meeting agendas and minutes. San Miguel Fire Department responded to our request to open up closed Finance Committee meetings to the public by doing exactly that and complying with the Brown Act. On the downside, we've seen some local planning group members rely on private email servers, making requests for email records essentially an honor system. The county has failed to provide an official server for its planning group member emails. It should do so, and the county should strongly urge all local officials to use the official server to preserve public records. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is Leon Thompson reporting for East County Magazine. That blue box dinner may have shards of metal in it. Yes, that familiar blue box of macaroni and cheese has been recalled. Kraft has received 8 consumer contacts about this product due to the possibility that some boxes may contain small pieces of metal. The recalled product is limited to the 242,000 cases of the original flavor of Kraft macaroni and cheese dinners in the common 7.25-ounce size box dinner. So check the best when used by dates. Some of the products were sold in multi-pack, you know, like 3-packs, 4-packs, and 5-packs that were shrink-wrapped. Customers who purchased this product should return to the store where purchased for an exchange or full refund. So everyone's favorite side dish will be scarce for a while. But in the meantime, here's a macaroni and cheese recipe made from scratch with a twist that you will love. Papa Leone's crowd-pleasing macaroni and cheese. You start out by boiling large macaroni shells. Then make a thin white sauce with cornstarch, milk, and a pat of butter. The recipe is on the side of the cornstarch package. Then you add, and this is important, grated sharp-aged cheddar cheese. Then you add a package of those little beef cocktail weenies. Put it all in a deep casserole dish. Sprinkle with seasoned salt and top with crumbled Ritz crackers. Pop in the oven until the cheese melts and the top browns. Mm-mm.
Lou Russo, an outspoken former member of the Alpine Community Planning Group, may soon be back on the board, the Registrar of Voters Office has confirmed. James Rowe defeated Russo on the November ballot, but he moved out of the area for a job prior to the election and is thus ineligible to take the seat. Rowe did inform the Registrar of Voters, but amid the election hustle and bustle, the paperwork was overlooked, apparently. After consultation with County Council, Andrew Spergen at the Registrar of Voters sent Russo an email which states, "I have been given direction that you will be eligible for the seat of James Rowe due to the issues you've identified in this unusual situation. To take the seat, Russo will first have to complete training required for all community planning members, as well as financial disclosure forms due by March 31st. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
A new accounting of greenhouse gas emissions connected to oil, gas, and coal extracted from federal lands shows that more than 20% of those emissions in the U.S. can be traced to public lands. The report from the Wilderness Society and Center for American Progress calls for a full inventory of those sources and strategies to reduce emissions. Joshua Mantell at TWS says the federal government and California have made great strides through efficiency programs.
But I don't think that we've really looked at the actual beginning sources, resources that are being pulled out of the ground, especially on federal lands, which are owned by all Americans.
President Obama issued an executive order yesterday calling for carbon pollution from the government sector to be cut by 25% by 2025, but it did not include the public land connection featured in the report. The study also provides estimates for emissions that come from venting and flaring on public land and water, with methane from those practices rising more than 50% since 2008. Claire Mosier at Center for American Progress says a full accounting is needed to be effective.
These emissions are not currently counted, and they should be. Any comprehensive strategy to address climate change in this country should account for these emissions and present a strategy to reduce them as well.
The report singles out coal from public lands as the largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. For Public News Service, I'm Deborah Smith.
The Sheriff's Office is inviting you down to the station to have coffee with the community on Tuesday, March 24th at the Santee Sheriff Station from 10 a.m. to 11:30 a.m. Coffee with the Community gives the public a chance to chat with the station's captain, lieutenant, crime prevention specialist, and deputies to exchange ideas and concerns over a free cup of coffee. The coffee event will be held at the Santee Sheriff's Station Conference Room at 8811 Cuyamaca Street in Santee. Extra parking is available in the Enterprise parking lot located next to the Sheriff's Station. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Ed Beretta.
This is Leon Thompson with a warning for consumers from San Diego Gas and Electric Company. SDG&E is alerting customers to be aware of people posing as utility employees asking to enter a customer's home. It's been reported that one imposter will distract unsuspecting customers while performing routine inspections, while another imposter burglarizes the home. SDG&E says its employees carry identification when called out to any job. The company warns customers to verify that the employee is wearing the proper uniform and identification badge before letting anyone in your home. Also, be sure that they have a clearly marked SDG&E company vehicle. If you are suspicious, call SDG&E at 800-411-7343 to ensure that work is currently being conducted in your area. SDG&E does often hire contractors to complete smart meter work or provide information on energy efficiency programs. However, contractors will never ask customers to leave their home for any reason and also carry proper identification. If asked to leave your home, don't do it. Here are some additional tips to keep in mind should you receive a phone call from someone posing as an SDG&E representative. Although there have not been recent reports of this fraudulent activity, SDG&E wants to alert individuals and businesses of this type of fraud through all communications channels, including direct mailers, in an effort to prevent them from becoming potential victims. SDG&E does not proactively contact customers and ask for credit card information over the phone. SDG&E customers should not provide any financial information by phone unless they have initiated the conversation. SDG&E provides past due notices in writing before service is shut off for non-payment. If customers receive a phone call that makes them feel uncomfortable and they know they have an outstanding balance that needs to be resolved, they should hang up and call SDG&E directly at 800-411-7343.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.
Welcome to Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read. My name is Raina Menashe, and I'll be your host for this segment. Today I'm speaking with Joyce Strand, author of Hilltop Sunset, the first of a new series about a financial guru transitioning from executive to winemaker. My guest has written three previous mysteries on message, open meetings, and fair disclosure. She also writes and publishes a blog, Strand's Simply Tips, and she's a reporter for a regional wine magazine. Welcome, Joyce. It's a pleasure having you on Bookshelf.
Thank you so much, and also thank you so much for doing Bookshelf. It's awesome that local authors have a place where they can talk about their books, and I thank you for featuring me.
You're welcome. No one's ever said that on my show. I appreciate that. Okay, let's begin with your new series. Your protagonist, Bryn Bancroft, is a minor character from your three mysteries. Tell us about those mysteries. And what made Bryn branch out into her own story in Hilltop Sunset? Give us some perspective.
Okay. Well, first of all, the first three mysteries featured Gillian Hillcrist as the protagonist. Gillian was a public relations executive at a Silicon Valley company, which has a familiar ring to it because, yes, indeed, that's what I did for almost 30 years.
What a coincidence, yes.
But at any rate, she encountered a variety of crimes in these three books, but always there and always present was her boss. And her boss was Bryn Bancroft, who was the chief financial officer at the company where Gillian worked. And as Gillian became more pulled into the mystery, so did Bryn. And so Bryn always had a role in helping Gillian solve the mysteries, but she also, in the third book in particular, gets really involved as a victim as well. And so she was just crying out. She had her own personality, which we discover very early on in the first book when Bryn accidentally walks in on her and the CEO doing the baddie. And so we learn really quickly about Bryn's character, which evolves over those three books and then definitely morphs into a new character in Hilltop Sunset. But she absolutely is a character worthy of being a protagonist.
Okay, she demanded a book.
She demanded it, yes. Absolutely.
Well, I'm interested, you know, now you said that you were a public relations executive. You worked in biotech and high-tech companies in Silicon Valley. But unlike Gillian, your protagonist from the first three mysteries, you never encountered murder. Right?
Right.
So why murder?
True enough.
What is it that you enjoy about writing murder mysteries? And what's challenging about it?
Well, first of all, I think I started reading mysteries myself when I was a teenager. Maybe younger. I can't remember when I read my first Nancy Drew. But for sure, I have read mysteries all my life. Okay, I've read other stuff too, but mysteries are my favorite.
Yeah.
When it came time after my most recent layoff, which happens in Silicon Valley a lot, I got to the point where it was difficult to find a job, and I was sitting around moping. My now late husband said, well, why don't you write a book? And I said, well, what do you mean write a book? And I'm thinking he wants me to write nonfiction, which is what I've done throughout my career, you know, written various articles about biotech and high tech and whatever. But he says, nah, write a mystery. You read enough of them. And so that's literally how it got started. And then trying to figure out, well, what am I going to write? Okay, I've read a lot of mysteries, but how do I create a mystery? And so I looked around and I thought, well, I don't know. And I read a few newspapers because that's what you do when you're in public relations. You read a lot of publications. And I saw, my goodness, there's a lot of crime in California. So I figured, you know, that's where I'm going to get my stories. All of my stories are pulled from real crimes that happened and have happened in Silicon Valley.
Really?
And in fact, some of the perpetrators are still in prison, doing time for their crime. But that was how I evolved my plot, if you will, my story. Now, the challenge then becomes, well, you don't know anything about mysteries or solving murders or even what happens with the murder.
You're not a detective.
So I'm not a detective. So how do I make it credible? And I looked around and I found out that I had several friends among my list of friends who were policemen. And I also found a retired FBI agent who actually gave me the plot for Hilltop Sunset. He recommended it, and it was a case that he worked on. So that helped me. I had that challenge was met by reaching out to real experts in the field who could help me make sure that my police procedure was credible. Example, I had a police officer, detective, show up in the first two books anyway, to help solve that mystery. Well, it turns out that in San Francisco, they don't call their detectives detectives. They call them inspectors.
Yeah,
and they're one of the few. And they're one of the, it's a minor detail, but it does add to the credibility.
So, can you tell us very briefly the real story of the crime that you based your new book on?
Oh, if I do that, it's a
It'll
spoiler.
It'll be a spoiler?
Yeah,
okay,
it's a spoiler.
Let's not have a spoiler. Okay, how about this? I know that you're a wine connoisseur. Your new book is set in California wine country, and you write for a wine magazine. Tell us what you love about California's wine and wine country, and how do you do your research for that?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure connoisseur is the right word. I certainly do drink a lot of wine. We'll
get
that.
A wine lover.
Yes, I'm a wine lover, I guess. You know, it's interesting. I grew up in a household that we probably didn't drink wine. In fact, I know we didn't drink wine, and more or less probably because it was too expensive. And I came from the East Coast and got married and moved to California. I moved to California at a time when the state wine industry was just beginning, particularly Napa and Sonoma, just beginning to be famous and well-regarded. So living in the San Francisco Bay Area at the time, that's the wine I drank. That's how I learned to drink wine, was Napa Sonoma. All of the names that are famous now were just coming along then. Well, then we moved to Ramona. And we moved to Ramona in 2007, just as Ramona was starting to do its wine industry. And so I watched and have participated and enjoyed watching the Ramona wineries grow. You know, there's now 26 tasting rooms in Ramona. I have to say that.
Or really?
My winery friends will get on me. And the wine is superb, and it's growing. The industry's growing. You can go out and taste at a beautiful setting. And so, yes, wine has become a part of my living, part of my life. And it is such fun to move out of the corporate environment, which is where Gillian Hillcrest was, and this is another reason I wanted Bryn, and move into the winemaking industry and start thinking about, well, how do you make wine? And yes, I do need to do research.
And you go to the wineries.
I go to the wineries.
Fun.
I mean, I don't want to make a silly mistake like explaining why you would do stainless steel instead of oak barrels, which any novice might know. So, yes, I am, and I'm doing more research as we get into the Bryn books because she becomes more and more experienced with making wine.
It sounds like fun.
Oh, it is. Love it.
I know that you're currently working on the second Bryn Bancroft mystery, but you're also writing an historical novel about a judge in 1939 California. Give us a hint about which judge this is and what real-life event you're dramatizing for us.
Actually, I'm very excited about this. It's a book that I've been wanting to write ever since I started writing it, but because I set it in a 1939 Ventura, by the way, Ventura, okay, California, I needed to do a lot of research, and I spent a lot of time up in Ventura at their museum library doing research. I've read all newspapers, daily newspapers from 1939 to get a feel for that, that time period. But it's based on a memoir of the grandfather of a friend of mine, and he brought it to me. And this was a judge. The memoir actually ended in 1942, although he became a Superior Court judge then and then continued on for another 20 years. And it's based on his life, but it is fictionalized. The cases that I pull in are some of his own that he actually did as a lawyer as opposed to a judge. He was very careful not to talk about his cases as a judge, as you can imagine. So it is based on his values. Some of the cases are from him, but it's a story about a fictionalized story of one of his cases that involves a witness at his trial who is actually a 16-year-old precocious wannabe writer. And the two of them team up because this particular judge was very much into juvenile rehabilitation as opposed to juvenile punishment.
Interesting.
And so the values that are espoused for this particular judge, the fictional character, are the values of my friend's grandfather, but it's not really him.
Right.
But it was interesting to figure out how to write a book when you couldn't say that they had a cell phone to check on or an internet to,
very
to find
different
information.
Very
so,
different.
But and a different kind of challenge.
But it inspired you.
Right. That book should come out in mid-year.
Well, that leads to my last question. When should we expect to see the sequel to Hilltop Sunset?
The second of the three, I'm doing three books in that series, should come out in November of 2015, this year. And I do want to add that I am introducing a character from Ramona, who will be a minor character in the next two Bryn Bancroft books, but then I will spin her off into a series, and they will be set in Ramona.
They're all demanding, aren't they?
Yes, they are. They are very demanding. Yes, indeed.
Well, Joyce, our time is up, but thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and again, thank you for doing this.
For more information on Joyce Strand and her work, please visit her website at joycestrand.com. Again, this is Raina Menashe, and you have been listening to East County Magazine's Bookshelf, bringing you stories of local literary luminaries and some great books to read.
The East County Magazine show airs Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays on KNSJ from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. You can listen live at 89.1 FM or online at knsj.org. You can also listen anywhere by downloading the TuneIn application for your smartphone. For details, visit tunein.com.
This is Marilyn Lyons with a health report that may not be music to your ears. The World Health Organization, or WHO, reports that over a billion teenagers and young adults are at risk of losing their hearing. WHO studied listening habits of people aged 12 to 35 around the world and found that nearly 50% listen on personal audio devices at sound levels that can damage hearing, and about 40% are exposed to harmful levels of music and other sound at entertainment venues such as sports bars and nightclubs. Besides hearing loss, people can also suffer ringing in the ears. In about half of the people with hearing loss, the damage was avoidable, not tied to age, genetics, or disease. WHO has launched the Make Listening Safe initiative. It asks manufacturers to create audio safety features and teach consumers how to use them. WHO also suggests that parents, teachers, and doctors educate young people on safe listening habits and that entertainment venues set safe noise level limits, as well as offering earplugs and chill out rooms for customers. WHO is also urging governments to establish and enforce laws that would restrict noise in recreational venues. Here are a few tips to help save your hearing. Turn the volume down to 60% or less. Wear noise-canceling earbuds, or better yet, headphones. Take listening breaks or restrict listening to only an hour a day. Download a smartphone app to help measure safe listening levels. And finally, if you visit a loud bar, nightclub, concert, or sports event, use ear protection devices such as headphones to help save your hearing.
This is a public service announcement from East County Magazine. The San Diego Blood Bank wants your blood to help save lives. The Blood Bank will be accepting donations this month at two locations in East County. The first blood drive will be held at El Cajon Valley High School on March 24th from 8:30 to 2 p.m. in the dance room. The second is at Soup Plantation's parking lot in La Mesa on Saturday, March 28th from 11 a.m. to 4:30 p.m. All donors are awarded a free meal pass coupon courtesy of Soup Plantation. Donors must be 17 or older, weigh at least 114 pounds, and be in good health. A good meal and plenty of fluids are recommended prior to blood donation. All donors must show photo identification. Donors are encouraged to schedule an appointment by calling 1-800-4-MY-SANDIEGO-BLOODBANK or 469-7322 or visit sandiegobloodbank.org.
This is a public service announcement from the nonprofit East County Magazine regarding the Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alert Service. During a wildfire, it's critical to receive timely news about evacuations, shelters, threatened communities, and other vital information. Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are available free to the public via email, or you can receive the alerts via Twitter on your mobile phone. You can get information on how to sign up for these free alerts at www.eastcountymagazine.org. The Viejas Wildfire and Emergency Alerts are produced by East County Magazine with support from the Viejas Band of the Kumeyaay Nation. This concludes today's episode of East County Magazine's radio show. We extend our appreciation to the East County Wellness Center for our studio space, to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technicians, Leon Thompson and Ed Barena, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Donnie Gentile, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jules, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, and Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road.
We also thank the County of San Diego for a community enhancement grant to support our Destination East County segment. If you have story ideas or would like to underwrite the East County Magazine radio show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org or call 619-698-7617. We'll be back soon for another edition of East County Magazine's radio show.